Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And brought to you by you. Thank you to our patrons supporting us every week at patreon.com/UKTech. If you're a patron, of course, this is your extended ad-free version of this week's show. And if you're not yet a patron but would like to be, to get our extended cuts, weekly columns, live streaming, and access to our Discord members club for chatting with us, head to patreon.com/UKTech to find out how you can support us for as little as $1 a week with no commitment. And thank you to Brian, Joey and John for adjusting their pledges this week. And also welcome to newest patron, Stuart, who I believe joined us very late last night. So just in time for today's show, which is fantastic. Now, some really interesting things are going to be landing on the feed over the next week or so. We have got what I think might be the best special we have ever produced, which is going to go out on tomorrow, on the 25th of December. It's going to go out later today on our Patreon feed, though, and it is a special all about astronomy, search for extraterrestrial intelligence, talking about science fiction, Carl Sagan's book Contact. We're joined by Pamela Gay, who is an astrophysicist and an incredibly knowledgeable woman in the science community. We're also joined by Tom Merritt and Veronica Belmont, who I know that some people will be very familiar with. And all five of us, including Ian, are going to talk for 45 minutes about space and SETI. And it's wonderful, if I do say so myself.
It is. I've listened to most of it now. I haven't listened to all of it. But it's really, really good. And it's really interesting and a bit different. I wouldn't have thought, you know, 6 months ago we'd go for something like this. But I think definitely we'll probably try and do it again, won't we, Nate? Because it was good fun and sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's really come out very, very well indeed. And we've also then got a outtakes special, which is going out to all on both feeds over the next week or so, but a little bit earlier on the Patreon feed, basically as soon as I finish editing it, which collates all of our funniest and most interesting outtakes from the year's shows. And I'll be honest, it's hilarious. It is pretty hilarious. And that's coming over the next few days, just in time for the New Year's hangover, so look out for that too. But also joining us this week is CNET.com's Andy Hoyle. Hello, Andy.
I was wondering when you get round to me. Hello there. I've been sitting here so patiently.
You have. Well, I had housekeeping to do, you see, so it was just essential to get that out of the way first. Andy's going to be joining us to talk about some tech of the year later on. We're gonna have a bit of a gadget nerd out in the second half of the show, but he's going to join us for the rest of the show as well. And we're going to start by talking about dating, not a topic that we have covered very frequently on Text Message before now, but OkCupid is a very popular dating site, and it has begun to enforce real name rules and insists, according to Ars Technica, that it is a good idea. So the company wrote an open letter saying, "We all have real names," and said that we want you, Big Daddy Flash 916, to go by who you are and not be hidden beneath another layer of mystique. Now, the feature's only going to display first names, according to us, and OkCupid says no outside service verification will be used to confirm that the name matches your actual identity. And this got me thinking a lot about whether this would change the dynamic of dating. Firstly, it is only using first names, so you're not having to use your surname and to be Googleable. And other sites have done this before. So Tinder, for example, is connected to Facebook, but only displays the first name. And Motherboard also wrote this story up and had a really interesting bit of insight from a woman who goes by Girl on the Net, who's a sex blogger, but she works under a pseudonym for privacy reasons. about the change. And she said to Motherboard that she went on her first date with a man she met on OkCupid, and they had a nice time, but wasn't interested in a second date and let the guy know. But apparently he then proceeded to get very drunk, send the woman a series of increasingly angry messages, which culminated in a couple of threats. He even threatened to contact her boss, apparently, but couldn't because he didn't know her full name. So the woman concluded to Motherboard that, quote, "I'm genuinely terrified for the people, many of whom may be far more vulnerable than I was at the time, who go on dates with Jekyll and Hyde type characters like this, who seem totally fine in the first instance, then turn into threatening nightmares." Now, OkCupid, for the record, has said, "We encourage users who do not feel comfortable to instead use a nickname or their initials." Now, I'm curious about how this would affect...
Well, in that example, it wouldn't really be a problem, would it? Because they would still be using just the first name, and you still wouldn't have any more details than you would if you went out on a date. So presumably her concern was she went out on one date, they probably only used first names, and then he started to be, you know, belligerent, which is disgraceful. So it doesn't sound like OkCupid going down the first name route would be a massive problem, although they're not really checking anyway, so you can use any first name you want.
Yes, you could technically use any first name. I could use Nate, but it's not a very common name in the UK. I would be in a small pool, I imagine, of London-based Nates on the site, I imagine. And indeed, I was on the site, and we'll come to that shortly.
I don't know what this solves at all, because if you you can still choose a nickname. I mean, that's all a username is. And
yeah.
So nothing's changing here.
Nothing.
At all. You can already use your first name and your surname as your username if you wanted to, and now you can still not use your first name if you don't want to. So what's changed?
Very little. From a practical point of view, I can see what they're going at. I guess it affects the people who have already registered and have built up a profile on the site. So obviously you wouldn't want to go back and then redo all that. So that's probably the only thing stopping it. But for new registrants or people who have an account and set up another one, you know, there's no restriction at all. It's not helpful. So. Mm.
And John in our Discord, in the patrons who are listening live, says he has to use effectively a condensed form of his full name because his actual full name is very, very common. And so having a kind of what's effectively a pseudonym or a nickname is kind of essential anyway. Yeah, saying your first name is John is not necessarily going to get you identified as somebody.
But John also suggested Lord Laser Thighs, which is perhaps the greatest name ever suggested by anyone.
It gives us some insight into how our patrons actually identify themselves to people outside of this beautiful podcast community. So what's interesting about this is, for those of you who don't know, I actually met my wife on OkCupid several years ago, and it's something I've always been very pleased to talk about because it's kind of a nice success story. Like, I think the stigma has gone from online dating almost entirely to the point that it is now just as acceptable now as using a, you know, what they call them, Lonely Hearts sort of service back in the day was. And, you know, there's no stigma. It's not like a nerdy thing to do. It certainly was when I was in my early teens. You know, if you said you met somebody on the internet, they would assume either you or they were some sort of stalker or murderer or pedophile or some other cretinous individual. Whereas now it's just, you know, hey, we're busy. We all use apps. We've all got phones. So internet dating is fine. In fact, here's a thought. I'm going to go and grab her and see what she thinks to this. Hang on.
All right, fine.
Kate's joining me here. Hello, hello, wife.
Hello, husband.
We met on OkCupid. It was a lot of fun. We both had pseudonyms when we joined the site. Do you reckon this would have made a difference? Like, would you have been happy using your real name, which is, of course, Kate?
I probably would have used Kate. I wouldn't have put my surname on there, obviously, because it's quite unusual, and I, as a woman in London, would be scared of being murdered by crazy people. I probably would have used Kate, but I think it makes it a bit less fun to just everyone have their first name, to be honest.
Yeah, that's true, actually, because the name that I had on the site, and we won't reveal what our usernames were, but mine probably told you a little bit about who I was. Yours was very amusing. Did you get any weird messages from men who weren't me?
Yes, as a woman on a dating app, you get lots of ridiculous messages. You get on OkCupid, you get like a percentage match of how closely matched you are based on your profile. And I was having messages from men who were like 5% matches to me saying, hey, where do you live? Do you want to go out for a drink? And then you look at their profile and it's like, I'm hardcore religious. I like hanging out with my friends and movies and that's it. And you're like, well, you're completely anonymous. You could basically be anybody. And I've written this whole paragraph about myself. And if you were so inclined, you could probably find out who I was and where I worked from that. So it doesn't make you feel very safe, really.
Do you think that you would get... Would you expect that you would have fewer strange, bizarre or concerning messages from men if they had been forced to use their real names?
Probably not. I think men who are going to send pictures of their special parts are going to do so regardless of whether their first name is John, because men like that are just going to do that anyway, aren't they?
Well, thank you, wife, for the insight there. You can what were you doing in the other room?
I was playing Legends, but now I think I've probably lost my game.
Oh, she was playing Elder Scrolls Legends. I'm sorry about that.
I think that's an interesting a point, though, about actually your personality being reflected in the username you choose, because I've seen accounts and it's, you can tell a lot from how people want to describe themselves. It's like a headline, really, isn't it? And if people want to put in Jim Bunny 247, he's like, okay, well, this person is really into their health and fitness. I'm a lard ass who likes cakes and sitting on the sofa. We're probably not going to be a brilliant match. So usernames have a really good place, I think, in the dating world.
This is all very, very odd to me because I've never done it. And I don't understand, first of all, I guess there are different services for different requirements, right? So Tinder was always sort of kind of a hookup site, right? So it's the entire premise of that site is to get you to pick someone based on their initial appearance. Presumably, once you get to the point where you're actually looking to find someone for a long-term relationship, you would use a service where the description is the most important thing. But I wonder if, especially for, people... I guess where you and Kate were in your the point where you started looking online using dating services, I do wonder if there's a room for a service where everyone is verified quite carefully. But and by that, I mean perhaps you have to connect via, well, probably not Facebook because Tinder already does that. But
there actually is. Lovestruck is one that does kind of verified profiling.
Oh, was that so... the one that you had a refund from?
It was one I had a refund from because I for a variety of reasons.
You didn't find a wife from there.
Yeah, exactly. I demanded my money back from all dating sites that did not result in weddings. So OkCupid is the only one that hasn't been demanded money from. But no, Lovestruck is one that does do a verification service, and it's free. It doesn't even cost anything. It's part of the fee you pay to be a member on these sites. And... And they checked LinkedIn and Twitter and Facebook and things, and then they actually put badges and say, yeah, this is a verified person.
I was just wondering, do they also look at your Twitter feed and think this person's an arsehole, so give you a special badge that says, avoid this person?
I don't know, because, of course, I never ran into that problem being such
No,
a...
I would.
Sure you didn't.
I would absolutely have that problem, wouldn't I? And with all of my, in fact, let's be honest, I'm going to have trouble no matter what I do on a dating site. So, but did you find that Lovestruck was a better service as a result of that or not?
No, I never actually used that feature because I think that wasn't in place before when I joined. But I mean, I'd used a whole bunch of dating sites and have some hilarious stories from, a lot of the people that I met on there, but most of them I found to be very, what's the right word? Like, they try and pigeonhole you so much that it kind of reduces everyone down to lowest common denominator. Like, you know, my interests include movies, going out, meals. It's like, well,
and fun.
And
don't
fun.
Forget fun, like, mate.
Let's assume we all enjoy fun, having meals and watching a movie from time to time. And so I tried, God, I must have tried five or six sites over a couple of years. And eventually, like, OkCupid had the right balance of kind of flexibility with a profile, but also
women you wanted to marry.
Women that I wanted to actually meet.
Also, though, there is something here that I do want to point out, and it is that you are a writer, I am a writer, and Andy is a writer. If we can't come up with a profile that's a bit more interesting than I like having fun, then we've failed as writers. But most people don't care about stuff like that. They really don't put any effort into the things they write. And that shouldn't preclude them from having dating fun. But I guess, you know, I suppose the point is that you would look for someone who had a profile that you were interested in no matter what.
I remember getting a lot of compliments, not just from people on OkCupid, but from friends who'd read my profile that said that my profile was probably one of the best they'd ever read, and that I should write other people's profiles for them because it was funny and honest. And
that's a good service. Perhaps you should.
Yeah, Kate says in the Discord, apart from mine, yes, that's true. Hers was probably better than mine, but mine was pretty good. I don't know. If I get drunk over Christmas, maybe I'll end up posting it as a Patreon blog, and you can all look forward to having a giggle at my expense about how I met my wife. If you've had any thoughts on this topic, if you've got feelings about using first names or real names on dating profiles, if you've had any experiences yourself using real names or having any interesting experiences on dating sites, meeting the geeky person of your dreams, it would be lovely to hear some stories. We could maybe talk about those in the new year or on our next episode, whichever comes soonest. You can send those thoughts in, and you can be anonymous if you wish, to hello@techpodcast.uk. Well, switching mobile operators could soon begin with a simple text message. Ofcom is going to be introducing an auto-switch system that forces providers to sort out the finer details of a switch on their own, according to Engadget this week. Here's how it's going to work. You request a code online, by text, or by calling your provider. Then you're free to shop around, get a good deal. When you're ready to make the switch, you simply give them a code, which is not a million miles away from the PAC codes that we have today, PAC codes. And then everything is transferred within one working day, including your number, if you want to, according to Engadget. But also as part of the move, Ofcom is abolishing notice period charges as well. So it doesn't matter when you want to cancel. But if you do have outstanding fees, i.e. if you were given a phone as part of your contract, then that'll be quoted when you request the code. So you'll get the code and the estimate of how much you're going to have to pay if you use the code. Now, Engadget wrote that there's a number of benefits here, such as making it possible to cancel your current contract without calling anyone, meaning you don't have to wrestle with a salesperson as they try and persuade you to stay. Now, personally, I think this is something of a disadvantage because you can sometimes get really great deals by threatening to leave, can't you, Andy?
Oh, you absolutely can. And we have both been pretty successful, I think, in arguing for better deals. And even if you didn't intend to play hardball in getting a better deal, I have been tempted to stay with a plan that I was otherwise going to leave because they doubled my data and lowered my price. And I think, well, to be honest, that's why I was going to leave anyway, so fair enough, you've won, you've kept me, let's all get on with our lives.
Ian, have you been have you tried this tactic of calling up saying you're going to leave?
I remember years and years ago when I was, I think it was when I started the negotiation for my new phone at CNET. I remember vividly standing in the lab, which was also a box storage area, and having a long, long argument with Vodafone about how they wanted me to sign up, I think at the time, for an 18-month contract. And I was like, no, I'm not doing it. I don't want any longer than a 12-month contract. And, you know, the constant negotiation about getting the phone I wanted on the contract length I wanted. And I believe I did end up having to suck up an 18-month contract for the N95. But hey-ho, it was a good phone. I didn't mind having it for 18 months, ultimately. And I probably got a good price. So one of the things I had to give, and at the time they really didn't want anyone on 12-month contracts. There's no surprise there. I did it.
I believe I had a similar contract for the N95, probably at about exactly the same time when we were both at CNET.
There are occasions, though, when you want to cancel a service because you maybe just simply don't need that service anymore, so you're not trying to barter, and I'm sure we've all been there, I certainly have, when I'm just repeating, no, please, I'm not looking to stay, I'm not looking for a better deal, I just want to leave the service. But the person on the end of the phone will still force you to go through every single thing they possibly can, no matter how many times you repeat, I want to leave, I want to cancel, they will still take you through it. It can take a long time, it's annoying, and they're only doing their job, but it's still frustrating.
I think part of the reason maybe why they are so insistent is they always have cancellation departments, or retention departments, as they sometimes call them, and I suspect they're on commission for the number of people they get to stay. So it's sort of in their interest, personally, to try and convince you as much as possible, because the...
I like to think that they get electrocuted for everyone that leaves, like a short electric shock from the seat. So it's they really don't want you to go because they'll be punished.
Well, it's nice to have a bit of sadism on the podcast.
That's why I always cancel my contracts.
Any thoughts you have on this? As ever, hello@techpodcast.uk. That's where to send them. Okay, let's move into a bit of a special feature here. We wanted to do something a bit geeky and nerdy on the show. We do spend a lot of our time, as we know, talking about broadband and policy and all sorts of things that relate to the wider kind of tech industry in the UK. We don't often just hone in and talk about gadgets and tech and things that make us excited, things that got us into this industry in the first place in order to write about and talk about. So we thought we're going to talk about some of our favorite technology of the year and why. Andy is our guest here from CNET.com. So we're going to talk to you first, I think, about what your top product of the year is, or the most interesting product of the year for you, and why. So go on, what have you got in your sack over there?
Well, I wanted to bring out my rebuttal, because I figured that you would be talking at some point about the Apple TV 4K, and so my product really is the argument to the Apple TV 4K, and it's the Roku Streaming Stick Plus. This year has been a big year for TV, in both the amazing new shows we've got, in the proliferation of services, in 4K, in HDR, in bigger, better TVs. Like, it really is the golden age of TV. And so having access to 4K HDR content is really important. And yes, the Apple TV 4K does that, but the Roku Streaming Stick Plus has all the services that you would want in the UK. You've got Netflix, Amazon Prime, obviously BBC iPlayer, ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5, and a whole load of others. And it does 4K, and it does HDR content, but this thing only costs about £65, which is less than half the price of the Apple TV. And it is so simple to use. It is slam it into your HDMI port, and off you go. It's great. And I think that it's that simplicity of use, its price, just means that it is really affordable to have and put into your home. Whether you're a dedicated gadget nerd who wants the latest, greatest thing, or whether you are, you know, you're buying it for a family member who just wants access to iPlayer.
Well, you're right in your assumption that I was going to talk about the Apple TV 4K. And the main reason why I'm so excited about the Apple TV 4K is actually because of Apple's upgrading of existing purchases into 4K films as they become available. Mm. Because one of the reasons to stick with Apple in general, if you've been with Apple for a while, is the ecosystem that you've invested in. You know, so you may have spent hundreds of pounds. I've certainly spent hundreds and hundreds of pounds over the years on apps for iOS, apps for my Mac and things like that. And so buying a new product, I know that they're all going to follow me onto that new product. You don't necessarily get that with some other third-party services like Roku. But recently, with films like Interstellar, Apollo 13, Secret Life of Pets, Independence Day, like a bunch of purchased films, I now just have in 4K on my 4K TV. And that, to me, is the reason why the Apple TV 4K was such an exciting product for me. It was specifically because of the kind of the retroactive value that it applies to your previous purchases. And genuinely seeing a movie in 4K on a 65-inch TV that you've never seen at that high resolution before is actually really, really exciting. And I've really loved that.
It is. I've gone back and I've watched quite a few things in 4K HDR again, just because I want to see how it compares, because I've got a new LG TV to display it as reference, and it looks fantastic.
Which model are you using?
Off the top of my head, I can't remember. The B7, I think it is, 65 B7, something like that. I should probably remember this so I can plug it and give them some credit for it, but it's nice. I'll tell you afterwards, and you can put it in the show notes. Okay. But it looks great, and it, but that looks great on the Roku, and there are there's a lot of 4K content on the Amazon Prime Video app, and BBC iPlayer is starting to doing some stuff, and of course Netflix. But the thing I think is going to be interesting as well is we don't really know what Google's plans are for 4K films yet, because you can get the Google Play Movies app on Roku. But as of yet, I believe in the UK, you still can't get 4K films. That's still a US-only thing. So it'd be interesting to see whether they try and compete as heavily with Apple by offering the that upscale for free option.
I have a feeling that the Chromecast Ultra does now do 4K in the UK.
Does it?
I believe so. Yeah, I believe so.
I seem to remember some pricing information that leaked. Well, it was on Twitter about their 4K pricing structure, and it was absolute insanity. It was extraordinarily expensive.
Well, the Chromecast Ultra costs £70, £69 actually. I've just Googled it, and yes, it is Ultra HD, and it is HDR as well. So that's half the price of the Apple TV, and that would work nicely for your ecosystem in the Android and Google world, as it does for me in the Apple world.
The problem is, though, that Chromecast doesn't really work the same way as Apple, does it? It's not really playing things in the way that an Apple TV does. It's getting a stream and relaying it to you. There are advantages to the way that Apple does it, I would say. And casting is fine, but you can do that on an Apple TV. I suppose it really depends on what phone you've got. If you've got an iPhone, you'd be mad not to get an Apple TV. If you've got a Google phone, you'd probably be mad not to get a Chromecast of some kind, because they are better with each other, I would say.
And I was just looking at this, and it looks like Google brought 4K content to the UK in Google Play in November. So it's about a month ago it finally did enable this.
But I wanted to talk about this as also a way of saying that I think the thing for me tech-wise this year has been the increase in really stunningly produced 4K 4K shows, and the increase in the bigger, better TVs to view this on. Like it really is a pleasure to watch TV these days in a way that I kind of haven't found it to be before.
Well, Ivar in the chat room in Discord has just noticed that all his James Bond movies have been upgraded to 4K on the Apple TV as well. That is something I'm going to have to investigate, because I've been long meaning to rewatch a lot of the old Bond films.
Also, I just had a quick look on Google Play, and you can obviously can get 4K to buy anyway. And actually, the pricing's not too bad. $9.99 standard definition, which is a rip-off. $12.99 for HD, which is okay. And $13.99 for Ultra HD. So that's pretty good, isn't it?
No, because that means that you're paying more for 4K than you are for HD.
Yeah, you're paying a pound more. You're paying more than that to go from SD to HD, and only quid to go from HD to Ultra HD.
But you're not watching anything. You're not paying anything extra for HD or for 4K on Apple. And in fact, there are some places I've seen that on iTunes where the SD, the standard def version, is the same price as the HD for some TV shows.
I mean, they all do it differently. And I think that Apple's attitude to upgrading people to 4K is brilliant. But I suspect that that is a product of the fact that Apple moves a lot of stock and can ask providers if it's okay to give people 4K versions when they've only paid for an HD version. And I would imagine that the companies involved in it would just say, well, look, realistically, people are probably not going to pay to upgrade. Why don't we just say yes and just eat the difference? But I would imagine it's only really Apple that could ever get away with something like that, because it just has the volume, where I suspect Google and others doesn't. Can I just do Plex while we've just talked about Roku and the Apple TV? Because you can get Plex on both. And Plex has had a really good year. And one of the reasons it has is the development of things like you can now watch live TV on Plex. So if you get a compatible digital receiver and an antenna, you can have Plex set itself up as a digital television hub. You can set it to record things on Freeview. You can, and then it will amass them in your library as it would with any other content, which is quite good. They're also going into live news and stuff like that. So they have content from companies like, I believe it's called Cheddar, isn't it? The Twitter service. I would imagine that with the launch of TikTok from your company, Bloomberg, Nate, I would imagine that that will turn up on there soon. So what they're trying to do, obviously, is get away from being a service that is used exclusively by people who've nicked movies off BitTorrent and into something with a little bit more legitimacy, which is good. And they apply that glorious look that they have and their rich metadata, which really is the whole point of Plex. It's that simplicity in setting it up. Gives you access to all your music as well, if you've got a large music collection. And they even launched in their labs a little kind of mini player, which is supposed to evoke memories of Winamp. And it does sort of.
Oh, good old Winamp.
I kind of wish they'd gone after the look a bit more, but it's a very small, light player, and it just streams music from your Plex server. And, of course, Plex servers are not as complicated as they used to be. You can put it on a NAS. You can put it on a load of different things. If you've got an NVIDIA Shield, that can run a Plex server if it's got a lot of storage or you hook up an external drive to it. So I would say from this year, Plex has had a pretty good year, and that's quite exciting. And I know it's not a bit of hardware, but it's still cool.
Ian, one of the other things I noticed on your list of tech of the year is one that took me by surprise, the Mate 10 Pro.
Yeah, man, it's good. I wasn't expecting it.
This is the Huawei.
Yeah, that's right. They've really done something quite spectacular. I've never had a massive problem with Huawei phones. The old ones were gack, but then most Android phones weren't amazing. Yeah, but the Mate 10 and also the P9 and the P10 are all surprisingly good. And I feel like it's very easy for me to come on here and say I love the iPhone 8 because I do, and it's very easy to say I love the Note 8 and the S8 because they're both great phones. It's not particularly challenging to anyone to hear that. But Huawei offers phones that are, well, they're not that much cheaper now because premium's the only way for these companies to make money. But it is an alternative if you want something with a really good camera and a generally great piece of hardware. Then I do not believe that you can go far wrong with a Mate 10 Pro. The only downside is, of course, no headphone socket, because after everyone spent all their last year laughing at Apple for taking the headphone socket out, they honestly couldn't remove them quick enough from their phones.
Do you know the thing that annoys me about it, though, Ian?
What's that?
Is that they have the Mate 10 and the Mate 10 Pro, and the Mate 10 Pro has a headphone jack and isn't waterproof, but the Mate 10 Pro doesn't have the headphone jack and is. And they said in their briefing, they told me that they didn't make the normal Mate 10 waterproof because it was because they couldn't make the headphone jack waterproof. And I pointed out and said, well, everyone else has done it. Samsung's Galaxy S8 is waterproof and has a headphone jack. And we said, oh, it's too difficult. Like, well, you just haven't put the effort in. Like, that's just literally just laziness. I was like, well, we can't figure it out properly, so let's just not. Let's just get rid of it. And that I thought was an annoying thing. But what might surprise you is my favorite thing about the Mate 10 Pro is that it's brown. And like, which may sound like I'm joking, I'm not. It's a really nice, like, deep brown, coppery color, and it's gorgeous. I think it's a color that I haven't seen on a phone before, and particularly when most
reminds me of the Zune.
It is.
I was just
going to
say the Zune. I was thinking of a pun about the Zune. I was going to say, yeah, I couldn't get my hands on a brown product Zune enough.
Oh, very good. But like, it's a color that we don't see in phones. You know, we see black, silver, and probably gold, and it's just different, and it looks nice.
It is boring. I mean, getting those same old colours over and over again is a real yawn fest for me. I'm looking at I've got phones on my desk, and as it's shaken out this year, I've got currently two iPhone 8 Pluses on my desk, and both are rose gold or whatever gold it's called these days. And then on my left hand side, I've got a Note 8, an S8, an iPhone 7 Plus, and the Mate 10 Pro, and they're all sort of blackish. So I'm all for a new colour, really.
Well, if you've got a brown product you'd like to wax lyrical about, simply let us know on hello@techpodcast.uk. Hughes to say it's not a great colour choice. Oh. One of the things I wanted to talk about as well here are surprising products. And this is something that came up on the CNET podcast last week, which I guested on to talk to Andy about.
It's basically the same show.
It's not. It's different.
It is. Except that we've swapped Rich Trenholm for Ian Morris.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. I thought Rich was great with it, you know, doing the movies and stuff. I thought it was a really good podcast. I would encourage anyone to listen to that.
Yes.
Thanks, Ian.
But one of the things that I talked about on there was a surprising product for me, the Beats Studio 3 headphones. I've not been a fan of the Beats products in general since their launch. The first product they released under the Monster Beats brand was very, very good. And then there was a pair called the Beats Pro, the big silver-backed heavy ones. They were excellent. I wrote about those for Wired back when I was at Wired. And I recently tried the Studio 3s. And the reason I wanted to try the Studio 3s was because they use the same wireless chip that Apple put in the AirPods, which means they work very, very seamlessly with all your Apple devices, but they're also compatible with non-Apple devices. And I was curious how that worked out. And it works very, very well, and it's great. But the thing that surprised me most about them was actually how good they are with genres other than pop and dance and things like that. As regular listeners know, I'm a massive audio snob, and I don't mind admitting it. And the Beats in the past have been always, you know, very good for the kind of pop and dance and electronic sorts of music, and they're sold at a premium because of the branding and the fashion and all that kind of stuff. And that's just, none of that is of any interest to me and never has been, so I've always kind of shied away from it. But I've been very, very surprised at how well these headphones do things like acoustic music and folk stuff and heavy metal. You know, particularly on the metal side, it's very easy for bass heavy headphones to basically come across as very boomy and fatiguing when you're listening to a lot of very deep bass and double bass drums in heavy metal going hell for leather. But the Beats do a really, really good job actually of conveying all those. Plus, obviously, they do sound very, very good for pop and stuff like that. The battery life is amazing. They last for probably 30 odd hours in my testing over the last couple of weeks. And that's great. The only downside to me is the fact that they won't work as a pair of passive headphones. So unlike a lot of noise cancelling headphones, which these also are, and also the noise cancelling, I have to say, works very well without colouring the sound, which some lower end models will do because of the way the noise cancelling works. You have to have them charged up. So you can't just plug a cable, which does come in the box, into them and use them as a passive pair of headphones if the battery dies. If the battery dies, it takes the whole system down with it, which to me feels like a bit of a flaw, and I think they could address that and for the
future. The problem is that when you use noise cancelling headphones without power, they need an amp, don't they? I have used headphones that work, and they're always a disappointment if you don't have if they don't have a battery in them.
It's technically possible because the old Sennheisers, they always used to have noise cancelling as an option, but you could always fall back to using them as a passive pair, and I think it added flexibility.
And I guess if you're in a bind, then, you know, like you're on a plane and you run out of batteries and you've got no more, then it's useful because you can carry on listening to music. But ultimately, it's not that hard to charge them up, is it?
And they charge extremely quickly. You know,
you
can probably
get...
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can probably get an hour's worth of charge, an hour's worth of playback from charging it for about 5 or 6 minutes. It's very, very fast to charge up for another few hours of use, which is great. And it hasn't been a problem for me at all. It's just a quirk to the product. And I think there are, you know, they cost £300, and you can certainly buy headphones that cost £300 that may sound better for your genre of choice, and you can probably buy some that have a sturdier build quality. I think they're built nicely, but you can certainly get more rugged models. But that's sort of the Beats styling, and they're very light as a result of that, and very comfortable to wear. So I never thought that I would catch myself talking about how great a pair of Beats headphones were on the podcast, but such was my surprise with these that I felt it was only fair to say they done good.
I could talk about the camera I've been shooting on for the last few days, because I think it's shockingly
expensive.
Odd. Well, yes, expensive. Ian, I know you like to
yes.
do some camera talk with me.
I do.
So let's see how this one floats your boat. It is the Phase 1 XF camera system, but it's got the IQ3 achromatic digital back. This is a medium format camera where you buy basically the camera and the actual digital sensor separately.
Mm.
But as a whole system, this thing comes together and costs for the camera body... about £50,000, and each lens that you'll buy is roughly around £10,000. So the whole system that I've borrowed at the moment is in excess of £100,000.
And if you wanted to switch that sensor out, so say you want to have both a colour and a black and white sensor, how much does that cost?
That's a good question.
I bet it's a lot of money, but it's interesting as an infrastructure, you know, like, because you've got the option of doing both if you really want to.
Yes.
So if you're a pro and you're making your money out of it, you'd probably want both, I would imagine.
Yeah, potentially. I think really, if you're a pro and you wanted black and white, you'd probably just go with color and just do very good black and white conversions. But the great thing, this is the one I'm using, is it's black and white only. So it seems just absolutely bonkers to be spending that sort of money and only having black and white. But having shot with this thing, I took this down to Dungeness, which, for those who aren't aware, is this weird sort of ethereal, almost post-apocalyptic landscape with full of these like broken down huts and like the skeletons of boats drawn up on the shingle beach. But a brilliant place to shoot black and white stuff. And this camera just takes the most superb shots.
But you'd expect so. It costs as much as a sports car.
You would, but I'm just saying, well, it costs more than a lot of sports cars, but it's, you could get a Lambo for this, and maybe you should, and just shoot on your iPhone.
So who buys these? I mean, who's spending £100,000 on a camera?
Well, two main groups, really. Either fine art photographers who do very big commercial work that demands the utmost in image quality, both in terms of sizes that you can print at, you're talking big billboards, or the amount of editing options you have, because the dynamic range of these images is so huge, because the detail is so huge, you can edit, you can do so much post-processing on these images without degrading the shots. Like, I've been able to do post work on my shots that I know I simply could not achieve on my even full frame Canon 6D, because the latitude to bring back highlights and bring up shadows in certain ways simply isn't there.
How many stops does it give you of
I think we're talking about six, maybe 16 stops.
Okay,
which is,
it doesn't sound
vast.
Dramatically more, does it, than a normal SLR?
Yes, we're probably talking double.
Oh, really? So, I suppose effectively they talk about you getting quite a lot of dynamic range out of a camera, but actually the reality is you don't get quite as much as they say, do you?
Yeah, and if you may be able to, on a lot of cameras, we say, oh, you know, there's a lot of detail kept in like the dark areas. You can bring that up, but the amount of image noise that will also be there, it's huge. Whereas in this, like, you can bring this stuff right up and you've still got an amazingly clean image that you would happily put on the front cover of a magazine or on an advert. It's amazing what you can do, and the actual detail, of course, is huge. But the other thing with this is that there's a lot of industrial applications as well, for like overhead imaging, but apparently particularly in looking at foliage growth, because there's no infrared filter built in. So I don't know specific details, but I'm told that it makes, you can see more relevant detail in areas of foliage without this infrared filter, so that's another thing that it's there for. But we are talking super high-end stuff, and I hasten to add, I am not a super high-end photographer. The reason I got this is as an interesting article to that I'll be writing for CNET about kind of, you know, what I've learned from using something so insanely high-end. I normally shoot on you know, consumer Canon gear. And recently I've done a whole series of photography features about how to take great shots on an iPhone. So I've gone lower end there, and now I'm just, for a bit of fun, going super high end and seeing what I can get out of that. And I'm really pleased with what I've been able to get. But
have you got a gallery online anywhere or places that we could point people to?
If you can follow me on Instagram with @batteryhq, you'll see all of my photography on there. And my last few shots I've posted have been examples from that camera.
Okay, well, we'll include a link to that and embed some of those into the show notes at techpodcast.uk or in the Patreon blog that accompanies this episode. I just wanted to move on to something funny just before we end the show, because my favorite overall product of the year, not just in tech, but my favorite product of the year is my new shoehorn, which Ian bought me for my wedding as a wedding present. And I've
95p I spent on that.
I mean, it's the best 95p in the world because it's brought me so much joy. John in the Discord is saying he's getting one for Christmas. I'd like to take credit for that. I've certainly recommended Shoehorns or Shoehigh to multiple friends.
I don't believe horn is a word that you can, you know, use that trick with.
Well, I just did.
Fine.
And I think it's a tremendous gift. Ian, you love your shoehorn, right? You still use?
Of course I do, because I'm an adult man of a certain age.
Andy, have you used a shoehorn?
No, I haven't. No,
because I'm 29.
If you go outside the room you're recording in right now, there's a shoehorn. Do you want to go and grab it? Put a shoe on and give us a live demonstration of what you feel like.
I am still essentially a teenager in that I mostly only wear skate shoes, and when I put them on, they remain tied, and I just shove my fingers in the back and ram my foot.
Yeah, but you don't need to shove. This is the point. You don't need to shove your fingers in the back. You need to get with the program, man, and you need to understand that that is a fundamentally flawed.
Yeah, but I'm young enough still that I can bend over to do that.
Yes. True, and while I can't, I feel like you need to have a shoehorn in your life. I mean, Nate was as sceptical as you, Andy. I have to say, when I started to tell him about the shoehorn world, he was like, "Oh, come on, Ian, I'm a young man. I don't need a shoehorn. That's an old man's game." Like, fine.
without getting a bit too TMI, this seems like a similar argument to when I tried convincing all my friends that moistened toilet tissue. Is one of the most life-changing things I've ever had in my life, and I stand by that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone should be learning that that's the case.
I think I will later on film a video of my shoehorn and also of Andy using it for the first time, so we can get a little bit of multimedia.
I'm glad you said the shoehorn and not the toilet paper thing, but yeah,
there's absolutely no way that's going on video. But Ian, I think you and I could maybe start a shoehorn focused podcast or a blog podcast, where we review the latest in shoehorn technology. We could call it "I'm Feeling Horny."
That would actually be very good.
U-horn.
U-horn. Yeah. That'd probably be a collection of shoehorn videos, wouldn't it?
It's hard to say at this juncture.
What I would suggest is that we put our feelers out, try and get shoehorn PRs involved, perhaps get the buy-in of big shoehorn, and try and make it so that we've got ourselves a real back-end infrastructure here that could sustain us financially for many years to come.
I wanted to expand on this slightly to talk about how horn innovation could be achieved in 2018. And one of the things that I like about umbrellas are the ones where you press the button and they extend themselves out. Now, a shoehorn currently, for the long ones, the ones that are about 1 foot or so or larger, they're a fixed length. So you can't conveniently put them in a bag in order to horn when you get to... it's a verb now. When you get to the office and then put it away in your bag.
Mate, they're 95p each. You could just have one at every location. I mean, literally every location.
Market opportunity. Create one that is able to extend on demand and charge £5 for it. That's a huge premium over that. And I reckon that, you know, for horners such as you and I... That could just be game-changing.
I can't believe this. We've got a name for the collective now.
Of course.
And the website has a name and the podcast has a name. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yep. Horn Club. Sign up now. Well, if you have a shoehorn... Oh, hang on. So Kate in the Discord has just linked us to a telescopic shoehorn on sale at Amazon. Sadly, it says it's currently unavailable.
It doesn't look like it starts off small enough, to be honest.
It doesn't. It's not what I had in mind. It's certainly good, but it's not... Great. Any thoughts you have, of course, on this or anything we've talked about, to hello@techpodcast.uk. What was your tech of the year? And also, maybe interestingly enough, for our next episode, what are you planning on buying in the January sales in the tech world and why? What are you waiting for, or what are you hoping to get under your tree or your non-religious spruce of choice this year? All are welcome to let us know. hello@techpodcast.uk. Well, much like Santa, as we record this, we have a bulging sack just waiting to rain down into households across the world. And Sebastian is the first to feature in said sack. He says, "Hi guys, regarding phones in school, we can't dismiss a measure only because it can be circumvented or because it won't cover all use cases. After all, there will always be cheating in exams or other assignments, but at least some students will follow the rules. Having to deal with fewer distracted students must already make it easier for teachers. As ever, loving the show, Sebastian." Well, thank you, Sebastian. It's true. We will always try and cheat the system. I say we. I have long since finished cheating at anything other than life itself. But I suspect that you're absolutely correct. We've also had one from Chris, and he had a very insightful take on the topic of phones in schools from last week's episode. He said, "I have a use case, though, for phones in schools. My daughter has type 1 diabetes, and she monitors her blood sugar levels with an implanted sensor. This connects via Bluetooth to her Samsung Galaxy S6, and that she then uses a Pebble smartwatch to see what's happening. It also means her data can be uploaded to me and my wife. She's pretty good at interpreting what's going on herself, but she's only 7. If she or her teachers needed something interpreted or advice, we've got the data to answer well." He says signal blockers would be a very bad idea for us. And he says while these connected implants aren't yet the norm for diabetic treatment, they're getting far more common. And I just thought that is an incredibly interesting way, or rather an incredibly interesting use case for why, you know, children under 10 may actually want phones in schools. We had one here from Anthony who said the answer to cell phone blockers would be a teacher's Wi-Fi network and Wi-Fi calling. That way kids' phones could be blocked, but teachers' phones would still work. Also, they could have a kids' network and filter times and content for the kids, just to for example, to only allow incoming messages through a school app. That's an interesting idea. I think that would take even more investment in the infrastructure and a lot more management. But certainly, having a signal blocker like we discussed, but having teachers use Wi-Fi calling would definitely be an answer to that problem. Ian, do you want to take Mark's next?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Nate and Ian. I've been catching up with the latest podcast, and I noticed that you covered Uber's latest hit and the recent denial of license in my hometown of York. The local voice, conscious that I might be in a comfy echo chamber here, has generally been versions of, "Oh yes, back in the dark ages," and "The York taxi mafia win again," and "Death of consumer choice," etc., etc. The facts that I've read from the ruling are: this ruling only applies to York-based Uber drivers, and there are about 10 of them. This decision won't stop Uber drivers licensed from other authorities from working in York. Based on those two facts, it would seem like the ruling changes absolutely nothing. The majority of Uber drivers I've used from York are actually from Leeds and Bradford and can continue to operate, which makes sense. I actually had a really good conversation with a black cab driver the other night that was extremely rational on the subject of Uber, and he perfectly accepted the idea that we need Ubers as much as we need black cabs, and he said that he didn't have any problem with it at all, but the issues that everyone has with them. And this was, I got back to Surbiton quite late and I needed to get a black cab. And Ubers were also coming to the same place, which they're not allowed to do. And they were getting in the way. And he said, you know, it's things like this, and it's generally bad driving and things like, you know, not listening, not being able to speak specific kinds of English. He wasn't so much against the idea that it's a job often done by immigrants who maybe don't have the greatest English skills. But he said there are some things that you need to have certain kinds of English in order to know what people are asking you and stuff like that. I mean, it's less of a problem in an Uber anyway. But anyway, I thought it was quite an interesting thing. And it definitely was a nice alternative opinion from a black cabbie.
We've, yeah. At CNET, we recently did a big feature where we, me and some of my colleagues, spent quite a bit of time with various black cab drivers. We went down to some of the big meeting points around London, and the differing of opinions was much more dramatic than I thought. But we had some people, certainly some of like the older crowd, who were, as you'd kind of expect, holding that very the classic Uber equals evil sort of view, lots of sort of vitriol fired towards them. But there are plenty who were more like, well, no, it's just a different business model, and you know, we need to up our game to do things. They need to find other ways of bringing in more revenue into their driving, which is why you'll see more cab drivers who have their black taxis with adverts on them, because that brings the individual driver in revenue from the advertisers, and so that's something that's being more common in light of that. But similarly on the Uber side, like we've talked to many drivers who don't who love being an Uber driver. They love the flexibility of that. They earn plenty of money. There's been a lot of discussion about how badly paid Uber drivers are, that isn't something in London that I've found, that in the ones we've talked to, there has been much of an issue. So it really isn't the cut and dry argument that it often is. Obviously, this isn't including some of the morality aspects of Uber with some of their their behind the scenes stuff with their executives that's been going on, but just in terms of their actual business practices, it does seem to differ quite a lot, certainly from city to city.
Well, it's really interesting, and thanks very much to Mark for chiming in from York with such an interesting point. So thank you very much. And the last email here comes from Andy, not Andy on the show right now, my brother, but a completely different Andy, a whole fresh Andy. He says, "Hi chaps, enjoyed the podcast this week as ever. Didn't agree with much of what you were worried about on net neutrality in the UK though. As Nate pointed out at the beginning of the segment, unlike the US competition between ISPs in the UK, the market is strong. And if one was to mess around and slow down or stop services such as iPlayer, then people would just leave and go to another in the way that they can't do in lots of parts of the US. I imagine Ian at this point is thinking cynical thoughts about how BSkyB might block Netflix or the BBC. However, we only need to look at the pay TV market to see that the companies do look beyond short-term gain. Virgin carry Sky channels, and just last week, Sky inked a deal to continue carrying from its largest sport competitor, BT. With broadband speeds ever increasing and data allowances for mobile expanding every year, the number one thing that makes or breaks a service is content and user networks, not prioritizing its packets. Spotify isn't kicking Deezer and Tidal's ass in the streaming music market because it has a deal with Vodafone on data not being part of the bundle. Cheers, Andy." Interesting. Ian, thoughts?
It's maybe not even so much about what the actual outcome is, but about the fact that it could go a certain way, and I don't see how we can really stop it long term. But yeah, I mean, all fair points.
Yeah. Well, if you've got a fair point or an unfair point or just a point, and you can decide on which side of the fairness line it lands, you can send that to hello@techpodcast.uk. That's going to do it for this week. Don't forget to look out on the feed for a couple of specials over the next week. The first up is going to be our big, fat, extraterrestrial astronomy and sci-fi special, which will be coming today for people on the Patreon feed and coming tomorrow on the 25th of December for everyone on the free feed. They're both the same length and they're not charged for, because we only on the Patreon we only mark the official main news focused episodes as the ones that are paid for. So this one's a complete freebie on us as a gift to you for all your support this year, and we hope you enjoy it. I think it's fantastic, if I say so myself. And then later on, a few days later, we're going to have our hilarious outtakes special, which in the current edit is sounding absolutely beyond hilarious. I've been laughing to death just editing it, so I can't wait to publish that. And then we'll be back. We're not 100% sure what we're doing over New Year in terms of episodes, but certainly we'll aim to have something out if we can. Also, thanks to Andy for joining us from CNET.com. Andy, where can people find you online?
The best place you can find me is Instagram, as I said earlier, with @batteryhq. Same handle on Twitter, and you can find my work on CNET.com.
Perfect. And also, I should thank my lovely wife, who's sitting in the other room, probably still playing The Elder Scrolls, for joining us. If you want to find something of hers online, she has a book published, a wonderful book called The Fox of Richmond Park, which is available on Amazon in paperback and ebook. It's very good. And the reviews speak for themselves. So if you fancy an interesting little gift to yourself or somebody else, why not consider that? It's a lot of fun. Let's go. Bye.
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 Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.